Hello, welcome to Growing Wild here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online and on digital. I'm Charlotte Petz, and coming up on this month's show, we have the People's Walk for Wildlife, which happened earlier in the month in Hyde Park, which will include the voices of George Monbiot, Robert McFarlane and Kate Bradbury. And we also have Leah Leendertz, author of The Almanac, telling us about her new almanac and all things around autumn. But first, let's have a song, and it's Ella Fitzgerald, Autumn in New York.
Autumn in New York, why does it seem so inviting? Autumn in New York, it spells the thrill.
Autumn in New York by Ella Fitzgerald and Louis Armstrong. Okay, so first up we have the People's Walk for Wildlife. Now this was a massive rally in Hyde Park earlier this month, organised by Chris Packham, who did remain elusive for an interview. I guess, you know, he was kind of busy, but I did manage to have a bit of a chat with him. But yes, unfortunately, I didn't get an interview with him. However, I did manage to speak to some absolute crackers. Just to give a little bit of background on the event, Chris, he came up with the idea of creating an alternative cabinet to the one that exists currently, with all different types of titles that are related to the environment. We have George Monbiot coming up first, who is the Minister for Rewilding. And George, he's, if you don't know who he is, he's an environmental activist. He's a writer of both columns for The Guardian and of many books, including Feral, which is very good. And this is him describing his role within the event a little bit further. Now, we were backstage, so the event had started, so there was a little bit of background noise, you know, with like a whole rally going on. Hopefully you can hear him clearly enough. So this is George.
Oh, well, I just wrote one small bit of the manifesto. I'm one of the supposed ministers. Well, I mean, the one hopeful sign is that if we did form a government, it really couldn't do a worse job than the current one. So it couldn't be more chaotic. That isn't to say it wouldn't be chaotic. It would be, but it couldn't be more chaotic than the current lot. So,
Minister are you?
What could possibly go wrong? Minister for Rewilding.
Okay. So what's that meant? Have you had to write something?
So my bit of the manifesto is about the mass restoration of ecosystems, bringing back missing species, all the lynx and the cranes and the pelicans and the storks and stuff that I would like to see coming back. And talking about rewilding ourselves as well, and about reconnecting with nature and finding those wild sides of ourselves which we all possess but we're often unaware of.
And why do you think doing something like this is important?
It's crucially important because it shows, first of all, that people do care about this stuff. It's not all Brexit, it's not all the economy, not all immigration or whatever the supposed obsessions are. That, you know, people really care. It's a question of showing each other that, you know, we can build solidarity over this stuff. You can't change anything without mobilisation. You've got to have a movement. Nothing changes without a movement. And to have this amazing focus for the movement that Chris and his team have created, great manifesto, this lovely event, that is the beginning of how things change.
It has to be cultural, doesn't it? It's always ground roots. It never comes from top down.
No.
So it's just trying to make as much noise and mobilise people as much as possible.
And there has been a problem within the conservation establishment in that the big NGOs have largely passive memberships. You know, they rely on them to send a bit of money, occasionally turn up to an event, but they're not really using those memberships. And the memberships are huge. There's enormous enthusiasm for protecting wildlife, restoring ecosystems in this country, but it's not translating into political change. And I think the big conservation groups have been far too dopey, been far too slow, too passive. They haven't in any way exercise their huge capacity for creating change. So in a way, this tries to push everyone along a bit and say, God's sake, guys, you know, this is a planetary emergency, and yet we're not producing an emergency response. We're saying, oh, yeah, maybe we can do a little bit of tweaking here and there. No, no, we've got to have radical and sweeping change.
We can't, as individuals, sit back and expect someone else to do it for us.
No, no. And we can't do it, you know, through consumerism, through buying a better widget. It just doesn't work at all. It's got to be political change. We act as citizens. That's the only way anything changes.
And just on a more day-to-day level, are there things that we can do that's just more helpful? You know, I mean, I know coming along to things like this and getting political change, but sometimes it's just the everyday acts that just accumulate and make difference.
Yeah,
well.
I mean, I'm slightly sceptical of the everyday acts approach.
Okay.
I think we need the grand mass mobilisations. That's what is going to change things. We have to show that we are a rising movement of citizens, which is not going to put up with this shit anymore. That is basically what our role has to be, and that we have a positive vision for change. We're not just trying to stop bad stuff from happening, we're also trying to encourage good stuff to happen. And you know, these elements are essential. We have to have that vision of a better world, rather than just saying follow us and the world will be slightly less crap than it would otherwise have been, which is, let's face it, the main environmental message at the moment.
So you're saying we need to aim higher than that, we can do better than that?
Totally. And this, the reason I'm here is that this is exactly the kind of thing I believe makes change. And we'll see it. This will make change.
Yeah.
But it's just the beginning. We've got to build in it and build in it and build in it and not stop. And we've got to get the big NGOs with their huge memberships. And glad to see a lot of them are here to actually mobilise those memberships towards that change. Because like, there's hundreds of thousands, millions of people in those groups. And millions more who love the wildlife programs and all the rest of it and claim to be aficionados of nature, but we aren't actually doing anything about it because there's no focus. So this gives us focus.
So we're going to be walking to Parliament. It is actually effectively a march on Parliament.
Yeah, yeah. We'll be breaking down the doors.
Have you got a baton?
Unfortunately, they're not in session at the moment.
They're not Saturday as well. What are you... I mean, Michael Gove, I guess, is the guy. His one's going to be reading it, is he? Or?
Well, hopefully. I mean, the trouble is, you know, I mean, he's... In a way, his heart's in the right place, I think. You know, and he really gets it. He's very bright. He understands it. But he's under no political pressure to make it happen. Let me give you an example. Name the Labour environment spokesperson.
Yeah, I've got no idea.
No, nobody has. I talked to some, like, prominent environmentalists in their field to say, who's the Labour environment? No, no one knows. No one, I have to remind myself once a week.
Who is it?
Sue Heyman.
Okay, great.
But, you know, where is she? What are we hearing from her? There's just this silence. Oh, that's no good at all, you know. So the pressure has to be across the political spectrum. It's great that there are a couple of MPs here. There's Kerry McCarthy from the Labour Party. There's Caroline Lucas from the Greens. They should all be here. They should all be here. And you know, so and we need, you know, to be pushing Labour and the Lib Dems to be putting pressure on the government, as well as pushing the government. Because at the moment there's a great big gaping silence where there should be an awful lot of noise.
You can always rely on George not to be shy. So that was George Monbiot, and he was the Minister for Rewilding. Some pretty strong views there, but it seems to be really what needs to happen for any kind of change to be made. You know, one of the main reasons that Chris wanted to do this is because of the huge decline that we have experienced, and it has come up several times on this show, some species decreasing by over 50%. You can download the manifesto online if you go to Chris Packham's website. If this sparks your interest and you want to see the sort of ideas that have been put forward. But next, let's hear from Robert McFarlane. He is another minister and also an editor of the manifesto. But I'll let him tell you more about his role. If you're not sure who he is, Robert McFarlane is an author. His books include The Wild Places, The Old Ways and Lost Words. He uses language beautifully. And if you follow him on Twitter or Instagram, then every day he'll post a word that is no longer in use but is from our language and has been lost. And it's a beautiful thing to read every day. I really encourage it. I'm a huge admirer of his work. So this is Robert chatting more about his role within this event.
Well, I'm one of the four editors of the manifesto, Chris, Greta Santaganata and Patrick Barkham. And so we've worked on that for 3 or 4 months now. And I'm also a very notional minister in Chris's shadow cabinet, or ideally light-filled cabinet. And I'm the Minister for Natural Culture and Education. So because I'm a writer and I'm a teacher in my day job, and I've written a great deal about nature and landscape and human relations with place, my job is to think about how and talk to people about how we can regrow nature and culture together in this country.
So what did you put into the manifesto within that?
So
it's a big one.
It is a very big one. Oh, yeah, bring nature and culture back together. No problem. But I wrote a book called The Lost Words a year ago, and that was an attempt to bring the very basic language of literacy of nature back into primary education, back into children's mouths and minds and stories and schools and libraries. And that has succeeded in a way that I could never have dreamed of. So I've learned a lot from that year about how things move through culture. In the manifesto, 10 points, the first point was the big one, rewrite section 78 of the Education Act. The Education Act, that's the section which tells us the core curricular values of state education in this country. And the emphasis is quite rightly on the spiritual, moral and ethical development of the young people who pass through our education system. But it says nothing about the natural world. It says nothing about our position as part of that natural world, and also that it's absolutely crucial state for our future, but also for the well-being of people. And I strongly believe that what is good for nature, broadly speaking, is good for children, and what is good for children is, broadly speaking, good for nature. They play better, they think better, they talk better, they socialise better, they become better citizens, if we want to use that word, when they're thinking about and in nature.
It's vital that we engage kids in. And I think the loudest cheer here when Chris was going through the age groups,
yes,
was about 50.
Yeah,
you know, that's yes, the main. And yeah, so that's what we've got to really concentrate on, is thinking, well, how do we engage the younger people?
It is, because actually, in as it were, natural time, in tree time, the children are going to be grown up very, very fast. You know, it's great to see so many children here. I mean, that's been one of the wonderful, wonderful things. There are young people everywhere, and I had a wonderful time in front of the TV cameras with them. They've been sending in their wildlife wonders, their spells to me and to Chris, the ways they celebrate their experience of the natural world in language. And those have come in their flocks, and it's been wonderful, wonderful to hear those. So yes, but it's hard, you know. It's I work with I'm trustee of a charity called Action for Conservation, and Action for Conservation works with 12 to 18 year olds. We spend a lot of time thinking about, as a society, thinking about sort of 3 to 11 year olds, but then we sort of forget that the really hard years, the years when we really want people to keep remembering about nature's centrality to all of this, is actually 12 to 18, when booze and exams and partners, you know, suddenly enter life and hormones are raging and all the rest of it. And that's the time when it becomes easy to forget, totally understandably, no one's fault. So we do a lot of work with that age group, and then just things like the intersection of public health and natural well-being as well. You know, we're dealing with an obesity crisis, we're dealing with more time being spent inside, this notorious survey which suggested that British children spend less time outside than British prisoners, which is it's quite a stat, isn't it? It's an hour a day is the prison allowance, as it were, to be outside. And actually it makes perfect sense that children should not spend an hour outside on a school day and school week in Britain. So, but of course we live interior lives, the outside in all its complexities and beauties fades.
Yeah, well said. And with this, so it's a march on Parliament, it's quite a radical move. What are you hoping it will achieve? And is this very much just phase one?
Yeah, it's phase one. And what do we hope it will achieve? It is a radical move. The document will not be agreed with by everyone. There are 200 ideas in that manifesto, and we want more. We want people who are listening to this programme, people who are here today, we want them to send their ideas in for change. How can we make change happen? Caring is not enough any longer. The situation is serious. So, yes, that's what we want. We want more ideas. We want to give this purchase on power. That's the really difficult bit. I think we have a bunch of brilliant ideas here, some of which are really low-hanging fruit. They could happen now, tomorrow, next month, and make really serious difference in terms of biodiversity, in terms of nature in this country. But how do we give them bite? Well, we hope Michael Gove will meet us. We'll meet Chris. We'll meet some of the young people here. I think Michael Gove's environment is probably the most hopeful environment secretary we've had in my adult lifetime.
Yeah. Surprising.
Surprising, right?
But he's doing
good stuff.
He's doing good stuff. A lot of it is not quite getting delivered as it should, but I genuinely believe he's thinking, he's talking, he can see a lot of the right things. And that's really hopeful. So I think we're at a position of extreme danger and a position of considerable hope, and that's an interesting political moment to be in.
The question I know you get asked the most, what can we do?
I've just been talking about that.
Yeah.
I think we have done what we can do to this point. I mean, I think there is this huge appetite for change, and to this point, in my own heart as well as in the hearts of many people I talk to, that energy has needed a direction. It's needed a very specific set of proposals for change, and we've begun that with this draft one of the manifesto, 200 ideas, and now we want another 200 after that. We want them to come in. So the ideas are there, the energy is there, the hope is there, and now we need to organise it and make change happen.
That was Robert McFarlane there. A real commonality between people there was that the everyday acts, the little things, just aren't working anymore, and it's bigger strokes that are needed, and to utilise those feelings of wanting to do something and of caring for the environment and trying to have a focus for them. So there are ways that you can get in touch if you have the ideas. They're really open to be hearing these ideas. So it's all on Chris Backham's website, which I'll put links to on the show page, as always, which is radioreverb.com, and search for Growing Wild. We'll have a song, and then we're going to hear from Kate Bradbury, who you may remember from a previous episode, who is also a minister on the manifesto. But we're going to have Billy Bragg, because he was there as well. And I think in the end of Robert's interview there, you can hear someone tuning up, and that was Billy in a van. It was very rainy, so he was very sensible in taking cover in the van. So this is Billy Bragg and New England.
I loved you then as I love you still. Though I put you on a pedestal, they put you on the pill. I don't feel bad about letting you go. I just feel sad about letting you know. I don't want to change the world. I'm not looking for a New England. I'm just looking for another girl.
Billy Bragg in New England. Seemed like a jolly nice chap, Billy Bragg, to the point where me and Kate, we managed to get a couple of tracker bars off him backstage. Speaking of Kate, this is her next, and she was another minister, and she'll tell you a bit more about that role. And we were just having a little chat about the weather. It was pretty rainy. We were pretty soggy. And so this is me and Kate Bradbury talking about the weather and more about her role.
Bit damp, isn't it? It's a little bit damp. We're getting a bit wet here at Hyde Park, but it's okay because there's lots of love here for wildlife.
Yeah, and if there's one crew that's going to have a high standard of waterproof clothing, it's wildlife supporters.
You would think so, although I came here in a woolen jacket.
What's been your role?
My role is Minister of Urban Spaces. So Chris Backham phoned me up in June and offered me a job, and I said yes, which is what you do when Chris Packham phones you up and offers you a job.
It was in Aston.
Probably would have done it. He came up with this idea of creating a people's manifesto for wildlife, which is drawing on the expertise of people from lots of different areas, and bringing them together to write about how wildlife was declining within that field, but also come up with suggestions for how we can change it. So because of my wildlife gardening writing and experience, he wanted me to be Minister of Urban Spaces. So I wrote about the paving over of gardens, the loss of green space in urban spaces, the loss of wildlife, and then came up with 10 suggestions for how we can stem or even reverse these horrific declines.
Can you give me three of those?
I can.
Top three.
Okay.
These will always be whittled down. I was speaking to Robert, and he said there's 200 ideas in that manifesto.
Yeah, I mean, it's not
workable. The manifesto is always just a huge soup, basically, yeah. And then you kind of distill it down,
exactly.
And you get to the good stuff.
Exactly. So my top three, hedgehog holes to be cut into every new fence, which would just be standard. So easy, just standard. All new fences
fencing comes with a standard hedgehog hole in the bottom. That can't be hard to do. Also, new build homes, new build housing estates to have swift bricks, house sparrow bricks, you know, bat bricks, which are all, again, really cheap to produce and really easy and cheap to fit as you're building the house. They become quite expensive to retrofit, although it's not impossible, it's just more expensive. But if you just built those into new build houses, then you would automatically have wildlife habitats in those houses before families, etc., started moving in. And that just takes the decision-making away from families. You know, you might think, oh, I really want to help the birds, I want to put a swift box up, and then you don't get around to it. But if it's already there when you move in, then that's brilliant. And my third one, what should I choose?
Can we ban plastic lawns?
Oh, yes, that was another one. It was requiring planning permission for paving, decking or plastic lawning more than 10% of your garden. So if you want to do that, then you have to apply for planning permission, which...
Which potentially,
I mean, you know, it's controversial, but it's, I believe it's the only way we can help wildlife in urban areas, because plastic lawns are killing our wildlife. Birds can't feed from them, hedgehogs can't feed from them, butterflies can't breed in them, nothing can live or feed from a plastic lawn. And if we really want to help our bees and our birds and our hedgehogs, then we need to reverse this trend. I spoke to a plastic lawn company recently, and they said that their business is growing by 10 to 15% per year, which is 10 to 15% less habitat for wildlife. So
Jane Garvey's got one. I heard it on the latest podcast. Oh, I know. I nearly tweeted her.
And she's saying how
with
great
you.
It was.
I nearly actually just tagged you in it. I might. She was saying how great it was.
You see, this is the problem. This is the problem. And they are really convenient, but we need to accept that. Just, you know, if we can make our lives...
doesn't work. No. Convenient is disposable.
We have to stop it.
So, final words. Just tack it in. And what do you think will come of this event? Because it's quite a big thing, you know, organising a rally. This is a march in Parliament.
I really hope something does come of it. I really hope, you know, the government listens. And if anything, you know, that more people become encouraged to do more for wildlife, to see more wildlife, to look out of the window and enjoy more wildlife. And if we can all just take suggestions out to just do, you know, just do a little bit more for wildlife individually, then collectively there'll be more voices speaking out for nature, and then it will be even easier. Well, it will be easier, not even easier, because it's not easy ever, but it will be easier to then lobby government to make these changes that we're proposing. So I think raising awareness and celebrating wildlife is a really great start, but also, you know, just getting these changes sort of put into practice would be absolutely amazing.
It was a noisy one, that one, wasn't it? There was a lot of more activity in the background, so I'm sorry for that. I mean, I got to speak to these great people, but also a lot of background noise, which was unfortunate. So those were Kate's ideas. Quite radical, the last one. I liked it, the decking, having to get planning permission. And plastic lawns! Awful things. I also wanted to just get an example of some of the people who were on the walk, and I managed to catch up... Full disclosure, he is actually a friend, but I found out a lot more about the work that he does, and it was quite representative of the kind of people that were there. I mean, it was a real broad spectrum, actually, of folk and ages, but as came up with Robert, then the main demographic did seem to be kind of 50-year-old white people. And so there is quite a lot to address there to try and engage a broader spectrum of folk. But just to give you an example of a voice from the crowd, then this is lovely James Adams talking about the work that he does and why he felt compelled to go on the march. Oh, and the bird song that you hear is where we were encouraged to download bird song so that we were all walking along and there was a big cacophony of noise. So that is what all of that tweeting and twittering about is in the background. So here's James Adams.
Hi, my name's James Adams. I work for a company called Igloo. We're an ethical property developer who help communities build new developments in urban areas typically. We help shape developments and always have a focus on the environment and promoting wildlife.
So what do you do within those builds to promote wildlife? What does that tangibly relate as?
Well, we sort of challenge the design team when we're commissioning a project. We engage with the community ask them what they want to see from a new development, and then we take their views and challenge the design team to create buildings and developments that have space for the public and space for wildlife, so that there's room for wildlife to flourish in amongst the buildings that we're creating.
Why is it important for you to be on this march today?
I just think it's really important that we start finding new ways of communicating the importance of wildlife and nature in this country. I mean, I'm no expert, but it's apparent to me how much wildlife is in decline. I was lucky enough to be brought up in the countryside, and you know, being brought up in that environment made me appreciate diversity of birds and animals and plants that we have. But in the space of my lifetime, I've seen that declining, and birdsong has certainly disappeared from the woodlands and fields around where I was brought up. And I think, well, I had the perspective of having been brought up in the countryside. I was lucky enough to have that experience, but for people being brought up in cities, they may not have even experienced the joy of nature and wildlife. And I think it's important, this march is really about finding ways of connecting people to appreciating nature and understanding how under threat it is, and how we can try and find new ways to reverse that decline.
Have you done anything on a personal level, kind of around where you live? Is there anything happening?
I live in Zone 3 of South East London in Lewisham. We were lucky enough to have a small nature reserve that sits alongside the railway embankment. And so this year we organised, a group of us on our street, organised a street party to try and bring the community together, to try and promote some sort of neighbourhood sense of community. But we also invited volunteers from the Nature Reserve to come along and talk to the community about the work they're doing at the Nature Reserve. They're always looking for volunteers and they struggle with funding. So we did some activities on the street, organised a British bake-off, cake competition, a raffle. We played some games, we hired some bouncy castles, and we've shared food and drink. And we used that opportunity to talk to people about how they might improve biodiversity in their gardens and the spaces they have in their back gardens, but also talked about the possibility of promoting nature in the community on a larger scale. And we're sort of looking, trying to build up that momentum and see how we can support nature in suburban London, getting kids excited about the possibility of supporting wildlife, kids and animals, and there's a real connection there, and they're the next generation that are going to help us to save this decline.
That was James Adams. As I've said, if you want to read more about the event and read the manifesto and see what was delivered to Parliament that day, then go to Chris Packham's website, which is just chrispackham.co.uk, and you can find out a plethora of information there. It was a great event. It was heartening. It was wonderful to see so many people. It was estimated about 10,000 were out on the streets when the march started from Hyde Park down to Whitehall. It's very much draft one, phase one, so you can get on to your MP. We're so lucky in Brighton here to have Caroline Lucas, who was actually there, of course. And, you know, maybe you could get onto yours and see if they were there and would they support the change. And if you're inspired or inclined to do that, then and this is the time. This is the time we need to build momentum. Right, let's have a song. We're going to have a slightly more gentle half to the show with Leah Leendert talking about her almanac. But let's have Harvest Moon by Neil Young.
Just like children sleeping, we could dream this night away. But there's a full moon rising. Let's go dancing in the light.
There's Harvest Moon by Neil Young. Did you see the moon this month? It's the harvest moon. September is the harvest moon, and it's so huge in the sky. It's glorious. Okay, so let's get on to our next guest, which is Leah Leendertz. She's an award-winning garden and food writer for publications like Telegraph and The Guardian and many others, and is also the author of The Almanac. Her first one was for this year, 2018. She's just brought out next year's 2019 version. They're really lovely little books full of illustrations and information that you didn't even know that you needed to know, but then you read it and you think, oh gosh, I love that, I know that now. So this is Leah describing a little bit further as to what an almanac is.
An almanac can be all sorts of different things. It generally seems to mean something that's about a year, a particular year. So it's not just about any old year, you know, it's about 2018 or 2019. Now they can be looking forwards or looking backwards. What my almanac is based on is really the old rural almanacs, which were in place to help out agricultural communities. So they would have had information about what to do at certain times of the year, what sort of signs to look for, when you needed to sow your crops, but also phases of the moon, perhaps tides, you know, anything like that would sort of help people kind of through the farming year. Lots and lots of predictions they would have had in the past about, you know, what might happen with the weather and things like that. So that's roughly what mine is kind of based on. And it was sort of looking at that and realizing that, you know, that all of that information is stuff that I quite like to have. Not so much the predictions, I'm not so interested in that, but I like to know what's going on in the sky at night. I like to know the phases of the moon, sunset and sunrise times. All of this stuff, you know, I think is kind of, you know, we don't need it anymore in the same way that people used to, but we like it. I like it anyway. So that was kind of where that idea came from, and the sort of roughly what mine is like and about.
Yeah, it's nice not to always have to use an app and to be able to see something written down and lovely illustrations.
Yeah.
And maybe a star constellation drawn out for you, and it just feels richer somehow. It's broken down into the months of the year, and coming to the end of September, we just had autumn equinox, which maybe is one of the more significant things that happens in September. Can you talk us through what that actually means and the significance of it?
Our seasons occur because of the tilt of the Earth in comparison to the position of the sun. So when the northern hemisphere is tilted towards the sun, we're in summer, we get longer days, shorter nights, more sun, more heat, all of that. When the northern hemisphere is tilted away and the southern hemisphere is tilted towards, then we're in winter, so the days get shorter because we're tilted in the other direction. Now, what equinox is the point in between. So it's equi meaning equal, nox meaning night. So it's the point at which we are just on the cusp of going from one to the other. So we have the autumn equinox in September, the spring equinox in March. So we've just had the autumn equinox. So what's happening is the sun rises on that day precisely due east and sets precisely due west, and that's the only day apart from on the spring equinox when that happens. So essentially it's like we're heading into the darker half of the year. We've officially left summer behind us now, and we are heading into those darker months is what it means.
And then heading into October, I love the old word for October the Anglo-Saxons used that I read in your almanac. Is it pronounced Winterfilith?
Winterfilith, yes, I think so. And it's a word that meant winter and full moon. So the Anglo-Saxons believed that winter began on October's full moon.
Slightly so pessimistic. And we'd hope to drag it out into
it?
November, wouldn't we? But
yeah, I think so too. It's I think we see the seasons slightly differently. I think that autumn was really about kind of harvest, so it would have been sort of the end of the harvest. So once the harvest finished, that would be, you know, the beginning of winter. And I've actually, that was in the 2018 almanac, I had the Anglo-Saxon names, and in the 2019 almanac, I've put in all of the names for each of the months in the various languages of the British Isles. So that's quite...
Oh, lovely.
Yeah, and it gives these kind of lovely little glimpses into, you know, the past kind of autumnal concerns. So we've got in Irish Gaelic, Deira Fór, and in Manx, there's Deira Fhuar. Both of those contain words that mean end and harvest, because this would have been, you know, the very last time to kind of gather in crops. But then there's a whole lovely other sort of way that some of the languages go. So the Welsh is Hydref, which is also the Welsh word for autumn, Welsh for autumn and for October. Now, Hyd means stag, and brev, means lowing or bleating. So it's like the time that the stags were rutting and bleating, and that's where that word comes from. And then also the Cornish Hedra appears to come from that that same root. And then Scots Gaelic, which is Davur, is also about deer. It comes from Dav, which means rut. So that was really fascinating, actually, looking at all these old, you know, all these original names for the month from all around the British Isles, and seeing actually where those came from was really interesting to see, you know, these kind of agricultural roots and hunting.
Yeah, it's so connected to the land. Yeah,
that's
inseparable, isn't it? I mean, that was so much language seems to be originating from that. Because
in ways that we are not necessarily, but I think we can still really appreciate how atmospheric those names are and those words are, and how they really call up, really conjure up, you know, what autumn would have been like.
Coming into October in the almanac, what are the main highlights? What do you point out as highlights for the month?
Well, October is a really lovely month for celebrations and things, because we've got Apple Day, which is always on the 21st of every month, and Halloween, of course.
Of course.
Which is amazing that that's coming around already.
I know.
But in terms of other things that are happening, well, I have a constellation of the month in the 2018 edition. So what I did was chose constellations for each month that were particularly high in the sky or particularly easy to spot at that moment. So we've got Andromeda. It's named after the mythical princess and daughter of Cassiopeia.
Do you know, I just listened to Mythos by Stephen Fry, and I knew that.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah, because he talks about Andromeda.
I have not listened to that.
Yeah, it's brilliant. It's absolutely wonderful. But yes, go on. Just boasting about my Greek mythology.
It's all drawn out in the book, so it's hard for me to describe how it looks. But its brightest star, Alpha Andromedae, is a binary star. You can also sometimes, on a very clear night, pick out a misty spot just above Andromeda with the naked eye, but certainly through binoculars. And that's the Andromeda Galaxy, which has been estimated to contain a trillion stars.
Wow.
About twice as many as the Milky Way. Now,
you wouldn't want that
the Milky
job,
Way
would you, counting
the,
them?
And, what's that, sorry?
You wouldn't want the job of counting them. Like, right, one, yes. Two, three.
The Milky Way and Andromeda galaxies are expected to collide in 4.5 billion years.
Wow.
And merge together to form a giant galaxy. So if you want to spot the galaxy that will one day crash into ours, then find Andromeda and find this little milky spot.
That's incredible. Wow, I'm going to do that. I need to see that.
Also worth looking out for in October is the Orionids meteor shower. So meteor showers, in case that people don't know, are caused by the Earth moving through the dust trail of a comet. So comets have a particular orbit, and we have a particular orbit, and then every year at the same time we move through the same comet. You can also spot, there's a couple of nice close approaches, which is where you can spot one of the bright planets in the sky. These are quite good. If you're in a city, it can be quite hard to pick out the stars and the constellations, but the bright planets are quite visible, quite nicely visible. So there's on the 15th, you can see a close approach of the moon with Saturn, which is just after dusk, about 14 degrees above the southern horizon. And then on the 18th, there's a close approach of the moon with Mars, which is at its highest at about 8:15 p.m., so a nice time to be out looking about 18 degrees above the southern horizon. It's just quite nice to pair them up with the moon or with each other, because if they're just lone ranging across the sky, it can be quite hard to pick them out. And that's quite a nice way to pick them out.
That's lovely. It feels like it makes us appreciate our natural world more. It sort of highlights things that we can go out and engage in, yeah, and notice. And
I think so, because
feel
I
the
mean,
rhythms
I,
of it all, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I like the fact that I now kind of know that this stuff is going on. Or if I spot a bright star in the sky, I can have a look back, because I don't have all this stuff in my head. I can look back at my book and work out what it is. And it is really nice to just kind of click into those mysteries a little bit more, because you know, it's all there. The information is all around us, but we just don't know. We're, you know, looking around. And I used to always be kind of surprised by the full moon, and I love to just know that stuff, you know. I just like to.
So it's been quite a learning process for you in writing these
books. Huge, yeah. I mean, yes, absolutely. I sort of had the idea of making an almanac with no idea at all about how to actually go about it. So we're on an extremely steep learning curve trying to find out how to get all this information.
I was wondering how each year, how they will differ, because there's some things that obviously are the same every year. So,
yeah.
Yes, how will it differ?
How it's the same is a lot of the kind of the tables, proper almanac information, the stuff that makes it an almanac, that stuff is going to stay the same every year in a sense. You know, obviously it changes day by day, but you know, that sort of information will be there every year. Added into that for 2019, actually, is tide times, because I really wanted to find a way to include tides. To make it different, I have got folk tale for each month.
Oh, wow.
And a folk song. So this one's actually got songs in it as well.
Oh, lovely.
Which is rather exciting. And then rather than just talking generally about nature and what's going on in nature, I have talked specifically about bees and beehives. So what we've got is what's happening inside the beehive every month. So what are the little changes that are going on? Then instead of doing ingredient of the month, as I did in 2018, I've done cheese of the month. So I spoke to a load of cheesemakers all around the country, really about kind of what makes different cheeses at their best at different times of the year. What are the processes? What are the differences between what the cows are eating, where they are, the temperature that makes, you know, why is blue cheese at its best just before Christmas? You know, and why is goat's cheese at its best in, you know, February, March?
Yeah.
And then recipes, all the recipes are obviously different every year.
It's available now, the 2019 edition.
It is, it's out now, yeah.
And it sounds like we can collect all of them as these go on, and they all complement each other, and there'll be something in there regardless of it not being that current year.
Absolutely, yes. I hope to carry on. We're certainly going to be making 2020.
Great.
I know that much. Obviously, anything beyond that kind of depends on how it all goes. But you know, I'm very hopeful. I've got lots and lots of ideas, and I want to keep going. You know, I'm hoping to keep on producing them.
I hope she keeps on producing them too, because they are lovely. They're lovely little books. She's going to have a different illustrator every year, which brings a different tone to them. It's a very rich, lovely little thing to have in your hands. I will put some links up again on the Radio Reverb website on the Growing Wild Show page if you'd like to find out more. It is widely available. If you're wondering how to spell her surname, it is LENDERTZ. So it's Leah Leendertz, and if you search for her, you will find her almanac. Right, well, we've come to the end of the show, so thank you for listening. And to everyone who took part, it was quite a privilege to speak to all of those people and to hear their points of view about everything that we've heard today. If you'd like to get in touch with me or the show or the station, then you can do that. And I am on Twitter and Instagram at GrowingWildFM. You can email growingwildreverb@gmail.com, or you can go via the Radio Reverb website, which is just radioreverb.com. I'm going to play you out with Autumn Almanac, of course, by The Kinks. And thanks again for listening. I'll be back next month. Until then, go well. See you next time. Leaves.
are the most ecologists.